Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Oh, my goodness. I'm here with Takeaway Movie Date reviewer and podcast co-host Kristen Meinzer. Hi, Kristen. Merry Christmas.
Hi, John. Merry Christmas to you.
And because we're part of this national radio program, we get all the invites to all of the best parties.
All the hottest invites. And here we are with the very biggest Takeaway celebrities.
I mean, Denzel, Cruz, Wahlberg, Diaz, Mick Jagger, Taylor.
Well, maybe. We would love to have had those people on the show. You know, actor Ben Foster came to our party
That's one time,
and he's co-starring with Wahlberg and Russell Crowe.
And Woody Harrelson.
Woody has actually been on the program.
Oh, that's right.
And if you search your memory banks, you will remember that Taylor Swift was on the show many years ago.
We discovered her, right?
Well, I did. I booked her, and we got her on the way up, which is even better than on the way down, right?
Or on the red carpet. You're right. The whole idea of celebrity is subjective. You don't want to meet just any famous person.
You want someone you connect with,
yeah,
whose work you love,
mm-hmm,
whether they're an A-lister or whether they're not.
That's perfect. Let's leave this tawdry holiday party before the Kardashians get here, then. This hour, our kind of celebrity, and yours as well, we hope.
Well, Scarlett Johansson, she's pretty A-list, don't you think?
I've never been a person that's been like a jokester, prankster. I don't like any of that, like, candid camera stuff. I mean, for me, it gives me incredible anxiety just to lose kind of control.
She left this party early, but she was on the show this year. So was Colin Firth.
I can't conceive of it happening in any other way.
And Jesse Eisenberg.
You know, he kind of is a guy who he's so introverted. He doesn't really know what to say.
But here are the voices in our Takeaway celebrity crowd for this hour.
Avoiding unhappiness is not the road to happiness. And that's a key factor, I think, in the notion of happiness, in that it is part of a continuum. It exists alongside all the other emotions.
Who's that?
Do you recognize Simon Pegg?
Oh, there you go. Yeah, he's on a quest to find happiness, aren't we all? Now, do you recognize this legend, Kristen?
If I remain still, if I'm alone and silent long enough to hear the sound of my own blood or breathing or digestion above the rustling of leaves and the whir of the refrigerator, my father is likely to turn up. He just arrives unbidden in the long-running film of my thoughts.
Oh, that's unmistakably Loudon Wainwright III, but I'm actually more of a Rufus Wainwright fan, to be honest with you.
Figured.
But another moment I loved from earlier this year is this one.
I was in many minds. I was in an airport bookstore. Away for many moons. Left the suitcase on the fourth floor.
Mike Doty on the banjo in our studio, and I got to play along.
Well done. But we begin with an interview that you're still thanking me for, John.
Oh, yes. This is my absolute favorite moment of the hour. I mean, she's completely A-list, and I'm such a huge fan. This is the first time we're airing this conversation with it. Kind of makes me a little dizzy to even say it.
Actress Marion Cotillard, her movie opening today is a small French film that packs a big punch. It's already getting tons of accolades. It's called 2 Days, One Night.
Yes, the star from Inception takes a raw look here at the reality of losing a job and the struggle to survive, something Cotillard said struck her very deeply during the making of this film.
Well, first of all, I'm a huge fan of the directors, mm-hmm, the Darden brothers, and I was very excited and very surprised when they asked me to work with them, because they usually don't work with actors with a kind of a lot of experience, and most of the time they work with Belgium actors. And when I read the script, this was something that I had never done before, this kind of character, and I thought that the questions that was brought by the script, the question about solidarity, the question about how we've created in our society people who at a certain point in their life feel useless, and how it affects your life to feel useless. And all this question was a question that I had in my life, and so I responded to the script. And
in what context have you had those questions? Because it sounds like you feel passionately about this yourself.
Yeah, but, you know, this is a weird job that we do. Yeah. Sometimes I'm like, what do you do for a living? Taking lives of others and living, you know, when you work a lot, you spend a lot of time in your life sharing your life with another person. And not only sharing, but like being this person and being this life. And sometimes, you know, you're like, what am I doing this? And particularly because I always choose very dramatic and very dark characters. But also the question of feeling useless in this world one year and a half before I read the script, I read those things about those people in a French company that ended their lives because they felt useless. And one of them left a letter and was explaining how terrible it was to feel useless in this society. And it's really it really comes from our society that we created this question, because if we're on Earth, there's a reason. And when you don't find this reason anymore, well, it's kind of hard to survive for those people. Mm-hmm. And all this is very interesting.
This style of movie making and coupled with your notoriety and the way in some of the films that you've done, the big studio films that you've done, where you blast through the camera in so many ways, it seems to me that the Dardans are trying to sort of strip you down to just really portray you in this just authentic, raw way. And because a lot of people coming to this film will know your other work, it's even more powerful. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. It's a very realistic cinema, but at the same time, their cinema in general, I've seen all their movies and I love them all. And it's they're able to tell very, very unique stories in the same city, because all their movies are based in the city where they were born and still live. Mm-hmm. But I just think they wanted to share an adventure with me, and they wanted to take me in their world. Mm. I think they felt that I could fit in their world easily.
Mm. Of course, did you find it liberating to be in that world?
You know, I find it I don't know if liberating is the right word. I learn a lot. It opens my heart and soul. The more I go in doing my job and visiting other people's life, I find it very interesting, and I get richer. Like when you visit a new country and you visit a new culture and you jump into the unknown, you will get something out of it.
You know, you and Léa Seydoux were in Midnight in Paris.
Yeah.
And you can really sort of see that Woody Allen kind of falls in love with his actresses and falls in love with both of you. But then we see you in this film and we see her in Blue is the Warmest Color.
Yeah.
And both of you are just like, absolutely, just out on the edge. And I just have to say, in the same sort of couple of year period, it's just amazing to see that range of both of you.
Well, you know, I love actresses. I think Léa Seydoux is a prodigy. I admire her so much. And actually, I have to say that in France, we have a lot of amazing actresses, and each year there's another one who's beautiful and powerful and so good, and I'm kind of very proud to be a French actress.
That's great.
And sharing this with many French actresses who are just stunning.
Well, this film and that film, Blue is the Warmest Color, remind me of, you know, films that just knocked me over, like Ponette. Which is just, you know, only the French could do Bonnet. And Small Change, Truffaut is just really simple story of kids, just kind of like you're there traveling along. It's not like you're being told a story. You're in the story. This style is really something so amazing and something that's really a product of France.
Yeah, well, it's a very realistic cinema, but at the same time, it's cinema. It's really cinematographic. And And I'm very happy to have the opportunity to jump from like a big production movie to some very different vision of the world, and especially with the Dardens, who are like kind of masters of this kind of. I wouldn't say it's a genre, because in the Darden Brothers movie, you have a lot of genres. Actually, it's not just film d'auteur. It's much more than that. You have a little bit of thriller. You have love stories. You have deep and strong questioning at the same time, and it's very entertaining.
Mm. Well, and it seems in some ways the simple difference between escape, which is what so much American cinema is about, and choosing not to escape, but in fact to jump into what's actually going on in the world.
Yeah, it's a vision that brings questions, and it's a good thing, because cinema does that sometimes.
Mm. You've got a little boy, right?
I do.
Yeah, and who probably wants to know what mom does for a living, right?
Oh, I don't really know if he knows. He knows that I'm doing something.
Soon.
Soon he'll
have the question. And I guess, you know, movie star is the easy answer for him. But I suspect you would prefer that he eventually understand that you're exploring these lives. You're almost a anthropologist.
Yeah, it's funny because I use that word to describe what an actor does. Yeah, we explore human souls, and it's very interesting. When I was a kid, I struggled with people's relationships. I didn't really understand how the human being worked, and I think that's why I became an actress, to kind of to try to understand in a way what we're made of.
Do you understand how human beings work now?
More and more.
Really?
Great. More and more. And I find it very interesting because there's no end to this exploration.
Well, I'd love to hear your son in second grade a few years from now stand up and go, "My mother is an explorer of human souls." That would be great.
That's a beautiful way to talk about our job, yeah.
Marianne, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
What a delight.
Thank you.
Actress Marianne Cotillard is the star of the new film 2 Days, 1 Night in theaters today. And stay with us. We have lots more of our favorite celebrities coming up, including the real man behind the fuzzy creature you know as Dr. Katz, and the comedian Maria Bamford, whose canvas is her rich, hilariously neurotic interior world.
The great thing about comedy is that if you talk about something that you're horrified about and you hear any laughter, that means somebody else has had the exact same experience. Whereas, like, sometimes if you go and tell a therapist something, you're working with one crowd member, and they might just be horrified.
That's all this hour. Stay with us.
Merry Christmas! Happy New Year!
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA Gref, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
This next celebrity is kind of famous in a fairly narrow world.
Well, a lot of comedy writers, comedy performers love her, and of course Minnesotans like me are huge fans of hers.
Maria Bamford.
Anyways, if you ever start thinking, "Oh, but I'm a waste of space and I'm a burden," remember that also describes the Grand Canyon. Oh, but I owe people a lot of money and everybody hates me. Hello, Europe. Oh, but I've done some other horrible, unspeakable, unforgivable thing. Google it! Somebody has done exactly what you have done, or worse, has gotten past it and is currently on a book tour. You're never alone!
Comedian Maria Bamford certainly goes where no humorist has gone before. Her troubled self is the perfect foil for Louis C.K. on Louis, right?
And against Tobias on Arrested Development.
And, of course, there's always the character of Maria's cool, calm, collected family therapist, Mom Marilyn, to fall back on.
One of my favorites.
Honey, we're in Turkey, and the building next to us is on fire, and the imam says we have to switch hotels, which is just crazy. So we're
fine, and we're going to go shopping, and I'm just going to wrap myself in a Turkish flag and hope for the best. Your father's taking a video of the fire. Joel, don't YouTube that, Joel. Don't. I think that's a State Department warning. Oh, jeez. Well, we'll talk to you.
I love Maria Bamford so much, and I feel so lucky that I got to sit down and talk with her about her personal story, about mental illness, about humor, and about a lot of other topics. She was totally raw and open with us.
My family is very expressive, hyper-liberal. We'll say, you know, we've always talked about everything, at least within the family, and if not, you know, on a public level. So the great thing about comedy is that if you talk about something that you're horrified about and you hear any laughter, that means somebody else has had the exact same experience. Whereas, like, sometimes if you go and tell a therapist something, you're working with one crowd member, and they might just be horrified, and then you got to find somebody else.
You're talking about some stuff in your stand-up act that some of it is kind of horrifying. I mean, I'm not saying you're horrifying. Some of the ideas are very intense and hard. Like the fear of killing or hurting people you love.
And as a kid, I think I was around 10 or 11 when I stopped. I wasn't able to sleep very much at night because I was afraid. There's a type of OCD that not everybody has heard of. Mostly you've heard of the kind where you wash your hands or you have to have things in a certain order. I have had some when I was a kid, started fearing that I was going to hurt physically, sexually, hurt my family, friends, strangers, anyone. And what I would do is to try to get myself to not do that. I would grip my fists. I would do sort of a number of rituals, staying up all night. And I couldn't tell it to anybody until I was about 35. Finally, I Googled it, thank God for the internet, you know, unwanted thoughts or disturbing thoughts. And within, I think, 2 months, I had done these cognitive behavioral exercises, and I was free from something that had plagued me since childhood. It was just unbelievable, unbelievable. And so I felt like it was, you know, I mean, well, the great thing about comedy, too, is that part of shock value, or that, you know, when you somebody breathes in is a part of making somebody laugh as you build up some sort of tension. So in talking about something, chopping up my family in chunks and bits and having sex with the chunks and bits and putting the chunks and bits on a Cobb salad and tossing it and feeding it to my friends, like, that is, and I'm not doing the joke, I'm not doing the joke justice. It is beautifully written, and I wish I still knew it. But that's the great thing, is that I don't have to, the power has been taken away from that fear. And that's what I wanted, I think, to share with other people, was so that somebody else wouldn't have to suffer from it anymore, because I wasn't suffering. And I think the same thing has to do with, you know, I've had bipolar or whatever they're going to call it. They're probably going to call it banana sandwiches next year. But that I've been hospitalized in a psychiatric facility. And I wanted to talk about that because I felt so ashamed of it. Like, my joke is like, you know, I'm going to kill myself, but I'm not insane. You know, I'm not going to go in somewhere. And I guess after going through that, going, oh, I would like to share that with other people so that maybe somebody else would be, you know, might not take their own lives or might be more willing to go in to get psychiatric help instead of, and not just psychiatric help, be hospitalized for it. Because I think that was my limitation. I was like, well, I'm not going to go in somewhere. You know, like, and it was hilarious because my mom is a therapist, and she had had a manic episode, and she felt this, you know, no, I'm not going to go in, even though she was a danger to herself and to others, you know. And of course, at that point, your brain is a little bit broken, so you're not doing so well. So that's, I wanted to share about that. But I think I could only share about it in retrospect when I was feeling a little bit better.
And now you sound like you're very much on a path that's where you're really being taken care of in all the ways you need to take care of yourself. Do you feel that this has opened up a whole different world of observation and material for you now that you're feeling happier and healthier?
Well, I hope so. I don't know. I'm sort of inside of it, so I don't know. I know I am much happier than I've ever been. One thing, I didn't want to go on a mood stabilizer before for the same prejudice of like, oh, that means you're crazy. And also there's side effects that didn't seem attractive. The ones that I've gotten from this, I'm on Depakote, is weight gain and a light tremor. And so I always seem a little nervous. But the benefits of the medication, and I think it primarily has been a medication thing, because I have never felt this good in my whole life for this long a time. For 3 years, I have felt, you know, no suicidal ideation even, or any depression, or, you know, just sort of I think what people, you know, deem to be sort of a normal life where you just feel pretty much okay. Also, I'm a little bit sleepier. But for the lack of wanting to kill myself, I'm in. It's good.
That's comedian Maria Bamford, and she is currently featured in the USA sitcom Benched.
Now, in a world of turmoil back in the 1990s, you could always find a sympathetic ear if you were a child or young adult of the 90s. Dr. Katz was your friendly, animated face you could count on.
So you weren't part of a group of friends at college?
College was tough. I used to wear an earring when I was in college. You know, not a pierced one, a clip-on. One of my mother's big pearl ones.
Yeah, you would accessorize.
Yeah.
Well, which came first, Bill, the earring or the loneliness? I mean, do you think that kept people at a distance?
Well, I was always shy around women, you know, in mm-hmm. high school and college. I mean, today, you know, they call that stalking, but I was shy.
That's the very first episode of Dr. Katz, Professional Therapist. It ran on Comedy Central for years in the mid-90s. It celebrates its 20th anniversary this year. Jonathan Katz is no therapist, but the Emmy Award-winning comedian cannot escape his credentials from that animated show, which he has brought to a live stage, recorded for a new album called Dr. Katz Live. The real-life Jonathan Katz, we learn, not too surprisingly, is not all fuzzy and animated.
No, I'm a real guy.
You're a real guy.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen a therapist, but I'm not a therapist. I'm a comedian. But I've been in and out of therapy all my life. That's just... And I kind of believe in the work they do, even though the cynical side of me says it's the greatest scam of all time, therapy, because nobody really gets better. But there are people in Newton, where I live, in Newton, Massachusetts, who still think I'm a therapist. And I finally have stopped denying it and just start prescribing.
You're really outing yourself, though, in this live show. I mean, you can't hide behind the animated artists, right?
Right, or just me out there, my voice. You know, what's wonderful about the CD is that I, too, am in therapy with my therapist, who's portrayed by Tom Snyder, the co-creator of the show. So I get to talk about my own problems, and most of them appear in the form of jokes. Although he pushes me, my make-believe therapist.
This comes up every session, Ben. Right. And I'm wondering if we... we have, you know, if it's about his self-confidence, because that's what I'm, every area of his life he seems to.
I don't think that's the issue. I really don't. I think, you know, I think if anything, he's a kid with too much confidence.
Really?
You know, I remember when he was little, he used to, he truly believed that only he could prevent forest fires. And maybe that's a lot for a kid to carry around.
Yeah.
Do you think quite seriously that this live show, in many ways, is an homage to just what a pioneer and a huge force in comedy that you've been since the 90s? I mean, you know, Ray Romano, Louis C.K. were, you know, big you know, stars on your show. They talk about you as right. being mentored by you. I mean, that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I really like that. I think it was John Benjamin who is this amazing voiceover actor who has a show called Archer, another one called Bob's Burgers that he stars in.
Yeah, he's huge.
And he's the guy who taught me that I'm allowed to enjoy the time I spend working. Because as a stand-up, which I did for 15 years before Dr. Katz, I did my act almost verbatim. I was like stuck in a one-man show. And then once I met John Benjamin, I realized how much fun it could be going off script and improvising.
Jonathan Katz is an Emmy Award-winning comedian and creator of Dr. Katz, professional therapist. He recently released a new album reprising that role for the show's 20th anniversary earlier this fall.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Actor Simon Pegg started out his career as a stand-up comedian, which is exactly the kind of talent that has made him an unforgettable character actor in the Star Trek movies.
And, of course, Mission Impossible.
Absolutely. Also Shaun of the Dead. His movie Hector and the Search for Happiness is more personal, though.
Yeah, it's really about his real search for happiness, and I'm so lucky he took me along with him on the journey of how he made the film and what that journey meant for him personally.
There's a dictum in the film which says, you know, happiness is not about drawing comparisons, or drawing comparisons can make you unhappy. There will always be someone with worse problems than you, but that's not to say that your problems aren't in some way important to you, you know. And there is a particular malaise in modern living when you live in an affluent society whereby you have so much choice and safety and relative ease in your life. You lose sight of what happiness is. And true happiness exists in chaos. It exists in a place of uncertainty. It exists more keenly in places of difficulty, which is something we learned, and Hector sees as well, going to South Africa, to Johannesburg and into the townships of Soweto, and saw probably more smiles and laughter there than I've seen in, you know, London or Beverly Hills. And that's not to say that they're happier or more comfortable. They're probably not. Their lives are probably more dangerous and more risky. But because they have the entire emotional spectrum, they understand what happiness is far better than people whose lives are just sort of bland and comfortable.
So do you think that that's the lesson that the film is trying to teach us, that the search for happiness is really about experiencing everything? Or is there some other takeaway as far as how we can become more happy?
No, I think there's lots to take away, but I think that's a key one. I think one of the most important ones for me is avoiding unhappiness is not the road to happiness. And that's a key factor, I think, in the notion of happiness, in that it is part of a continuum. It exists alongside all the other emotions. And if you want the rainbow, you have to have every color in it. You know, you have to have the blue as well as the yellow and all that lies in between. And I think it's a key thing to embrace happiness as a system. It's not as a destination. You know, to use the rainbow sort of analogy again, if you chase a rainbow, you'll never get to it. But if you learn to enjoy sort of running, chasing, you might achieve happiness. Happiness is something we experience as a side effect of doing other things. It's almost like a byproduct, you know.
So is your definition of happiness different now than before you started making Hector?
I think I have a clear idea of what happiness is. Hector is the story of a man, but it's told from the point of view of a small child, and that child is Hector's sort of inner child, which is an important part of our emotional makeup that we need to maintain contact with at all times, because we have a very pure view of happiness as children. It's unadulterated by cynicism and by experience and by the burdens of being a grown-up, you know, mortality, taxes, all that kind of stuff that weighs us down as we get older. We have a very pure way of looking at the world when we're kids. And if we can somehow keep aligned to that and try and view things through the prism of being a child, it can help you unlock elements of your happiness. You know, like I always try and regard my job, which is a lot of fun, as I would if I was seven. You know, when I got the role in Star Trek, I thought, God, what would my seven-year-old self think of this? He would be absolutely apoplectic with joy, you know.
Screaming and jumping up and down.
Yeah, so I think the key is to kind of almost achieve a sort of vicarious happiness through yourself, through your childhood self, by trying to maintain that perspective. And it's it's an interesting way. Also, just being kind. Kindness is a direct route to happiness, you know, because you can make other people happy. And in doing so, you make yourself happy and they become happy and they want to make other people happy. And it's a sort of, you know, one begets the other. Tolerance, love, all these things are really, really important in creating happiness. And it's strange that we're partway into the 21st century and we seem to be more unhappy than we've ever been as a species. You know, it's there's more unrest, more intolerance, more hate knocking around. It's depressing. I mean, we need to engender in our children direct interaction with other people. Interacting with strangers can actually create happiness. You know, if you're in an elevator and it's really silent, say something to the person in there. You'd be surprised how they will respond, you know. It's important. The more insular we become, the more we look at our phones all the time, text each other rather than talk to each other, we're shying away from interaction, and interaction can create goodwill, and goodwill can create happiness.
Simon Pegg is the star of the movie Hector and the Search for Happiness. It appeared in theaters this fall.
I haven't got the blues yet, but I am somewhat depressed. I own several pairs of shoes. Should I choose to get dressed?
When he writes songs, Loudon Wainwright III loves to look back at the high points and low points of his life. But when he sings and just shoots the breeze, he faces squarely forward with a sunny face that says, hey, what's next? Hard to believe the writer of Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road, that combines the prophetic truth of Plato with the universality of a Marx Brothers gag, hard to believe he's in his 60s now. His famous Life magazine journalist father passed away in 1988, and in this period of his creative life, Loudon has created a new album and a one-man show called Surviving Twin that he says is an opportunity to collaborate posthumously with Loudon 1 and 2 and feel proud of, and to just express his feelings about his very creative and musical family as well.
I'm very proud of that and jealous.
Really? Really?
I'm being a little flip, but it's the Oedipal thing, you know? You know, I don't want to be replaced. when I read articles about any of them, and they say, when they refer to the person they're writing about as Wainwright, I think, wait a minute, I'm Wainwright.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wainwright's fifth album is a beautiful piece of work, and it's just that.
Wainwright is not a generic term. Be more specific here.
Exactly.
What made you decide to do this show?
Well, a lot of that is related to that, you know, because my dad was well known growing up, so I know what it was like to have a famous father, and it was thrilling and irritating, and we had a kind of competitive relationship, I'd say. Anyway, he died in 1988, and I found myself going back and rereading all his work.
Wow.
And a lot of it I loved, particularly his personal stuff. And then I started, and on that record, Older Than My Old Man Now, I actually did two recitations of his work and connected them with a couple of my songs.
What's that song?
Well, there's a recitation, he does this thing called, about his father, Loudon the First, which goes, if I remain still, if I'm alone and silent long enough to hear the sound of my own blood or breathing or digestion above the rustling of leaves and the whir of the refrigerator, my father is likely to turn up. He just arrives unbidden in the long-running film of my thoughts, like Hitchcock in his pictures. And he looks for all these 40-plus years of disembodiment, much like himself, big and sandy-haired with freckles on the backs of his hands, perhaps a bit more diffident in the way he holds himself than I remember. He doesn't stay long. And as far as I can tell, his visits have no message. Yet even though years of therapy have led me to make the dark, whistling claim that he's finally dead and gone, my father, who died when I was 17, continues to be my principal ghost, a lifelong eminence grise, and only my own end will finish it.
Holy moly. Those are your dad's words about your grandpa.
Yeah, and then I follow with the song.
Older than my old man now. He died at 63, that's way too young. Now you gotta feed me, now you gotta need me, and I feel like a faithless son.
That's intimidating, that language, that just flowing language. like that. Wow. It just sounds like it came to him in one single thought.
Well, I think he was a good writer. He was a great writer, I think. Yeah. And that's part of the fun of this, is despite the competitive thing, now more than 25 years after he's passed away, I'm celebrating his work and connecting it with mine.
Was there ever a moment when you went back and looked at that material and wished that that voice had addressed just you?
Yes. I mean, I remember going to his memorial service and meeting all these people that knew him that I didn't know, people in his therapy group and people that were younger than me at the time. And they were talking about what a great, warm, wonderful, open, accessible guy. Your dad was the most, you know, and I believe them. I think he was. Yeah. But again, when you're in a situation with your own kids, it's you're being the dad and you're being then. And they're the gosh, they. What a pain in the ass you kids are, you know.
You know, it's really disorienting for kids to realize that their parents had a life, first of all, before them,
mm-hmm.
and have a whole life without them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have a song which is actually on my new record that I wrote for Rufus's 40th birthday, which was last July.
Right.
And the name of the song is I Knew Your Mother.
I knew your mother, let me be clear. We were lovers before you got here. So don't forget that I knew her when love was the means and you were the end.
And there's a little thing about the biblical aspect of that.
Right, right.
But also, that's exactly what the song is about. It's about, you know, I knew her before you were here.
Right.
We were in love with each other. We had sex together. And then you came along. And the payoff is love was the means and you were the end.
You wrote in this album about depression, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you write about depression?
It's what's going on. So I'm writing about it. I have it sometimes. I have some friends that have had it. I mean, worse than me.
Blind Lemon sings the blues. The Jew does his wailing session. So tell me what you plan to do about all of that depression. Will you suck it up or ride it out or reread some old fan letter or head to the nearest bar room to stay drunk till it gets better?
You know, depression is so mystifying because in many ways the power of depression comes from how at odds it is with the objective reality of your life. I mean, you look at your life, it's like, it must be just like laughs all the time. Loudon Wayne,
looks
dead
great.
Skunk, middle of the road, Rufus Wainwright. You're depressed. What a waste of depression.
Yeah.
For you to be depressed.
Yeah. Well, then you have to get depressed about being depressed. It's just, you know, or you hate, you know, you loathe yourself. Or well, why should I be wallowing in my... But again, I go back to the theory that what's happening to me is happening to you, the big, you know, the public. So the idea is to affect people, you know, to make some kind of a connection.
Loudon Wainwright III is a singer-songwriter. His latest album, Haven't Got the Blues Yet, was released in September.
There's one or two lads that I could call my chums. They're canny and meek as can.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Finally, what's better than Christmas with a banjo? Why, that's Christmas with two banjos, even if one of them is a banjo wannabe.
When you're going out, you're living your own scene. When you need to shout, you dance in your own dream. When the night is long, when the night is long, when you're in your song.
That's me playing wannabe backup banjo with singer-songwriter Mike Doty on When the Night is Long. Doty is former lead singer for Soul Coughing. We wanted to match his rich voice, backed by a pair of banjos, with his equally strong opinions about the world.
You must have strong opinions, right?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. I guess I do. I mean, I'm a contrarian.
This conversation with Mike Doty begins with one of his thoughtful, gentle solo songs. These Are Your Friends.
These are your friends. And hey, do you want to go out? Do you want to burn? Limp and knock the chumps down. Hey, do you want to dance? Seize the mysteries. Hold them in your hands. These are your friends. These are your friends. These are your friends. These are your friends.
The voice of Mike Doty, former lead singer for Soul Coughing. His latest two albums are Live at Ken's House and Stellar Motel. Playing the banjo, and that's your tune?
That's my song, yeah. Well, I actually wrote the Is Change a Crime part, which, you know, is whatever, 8 bars. I wrote with Roseanne Cash, actually.
Oh.
A song that she rejected. And I was like, Rose, let me have those 8 bars, and she was willing. I had to beg her to take a percentage of the copyright because she was like, no, it's fine. Give me lunch sometime. And I was like, no, it's not right. Really, I just wanted to have co-written a song with her. So eventually I talked her into taking pi. 3.14.15, I think.
Oh, that's,
you know, to about 7 digits or so.
I was hipster-y.
Like, yes, yeah, I was like, yeah. I was like, will you take pie? And she was like, I'll take pie.
Roseanne is such a song maniac. I mean, she just loves this idea of there are songs and they're up there in heaven and we all are coaxing them out of heaven so that we can hear them on the earth.
Totally.
Yeah. You must have strong opinions, right?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. I grew up in a conservative family with my dad was in the military. He was relatively liberal for the military, but he comes from Louisiana, very conservative family down there. Many of them work in fracking.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And there's so many things that people that are of my political persuasion, I think, wow, yeah, how can you be so dumb? Like, it's the people that I agree with, I tend to get into arguments with.
If you mix it up more. If you have a background like you have, you're running into people who are very narrow-minded, even though they think they're like liberal, progressive, whatever.
Indeed, and the inevitable argument you get is, but we're the smart people.
Yeah.
Like at the end of the day, they're like, no. But see, you don't understand. We're smart and we know better, and it's very disappointing, particularly if you consider the liberal credo to be, you know, critical thought in all areas, relentless self-questioning. And it just seems it's like you really have never met anybody that disagrees with you. You've never met anybody for whom that, like, you know, that's my damn job.
Or who's in the oil business.
Who's in the oil business. No. People in my family who work in the energy industry would say, what do you think you're doing that's safer? Like, the implied message when you get into, any kind of argument with them is, if you think that before fracking, whatever energy you were consuming, if you think there was any less of an environmental threat, that you're dreaming.
That's an interesting argument.
You know,
so does this make its way into your music, this kind of stuff, these kind of issues, these ideas? You worked with MoveOn.org for a while.
Yeah, I mean, that's when I've done political messages, they've been very broad, very broad political songs. They always come out very easily, which is really surprising. You know, I'm fundamentally a liberal, like a liberal. And I guess I just am increasingly astonished at the people that I agree with.
And the narrow-mindedness.
And
the difficulty to have an argument. It's difficult to have a political argument in America today anyway. You know, it's not really about what the future of America is, that sort of thing.
And there's very little room for subtlety. What I always find is if I bring up like, well, you know, actually the other people think differently about fracking, or other people think differently about guns, or other people think differently about creationism, I end up being spoken to as if I'm like a creationist pro-fracker. And there's just no room for You know, like, maybe we are wrong about some things, right about other things. Maybe there are shades within our belief system, and maybe there's a level of self-questioning that's just not present.
You think it matters if the Democrats lose the Senate in 2014?
No. Here's what makes me angry. Here's what made me really angry during Occupy. Is I tweeted this at least once a day. I said, New York State Democratic headquarters is on 28th and Park Avenue South. Go there. You're not scaring Wall Street. You will scare the Democratic Party. So all that energy, have you ever walked into a primary election to a polling place? There's nobody there. There's nobody there. You get 100 people to support a progressive candidate, you will get him on the ballot or her on the ballot. I think the Republicans generally acknowledge in private that the Tea Party are loonies, and yet they brought the world economy to the brink of collapse with the debt ceiling. You know, and I hear people who considerably further to the left than I am say, like, well, this, you know, the system's ever going to change. The system never serves us. Just try. Just once. Concerted effort within the system. Just once. Prove yourself right. Just do it. Just put absolutely all your energy into putting a socialist on the ballot in New York City.
Mike Doty, former lead singer for Soul Coughing, his latest two albums, Live at Ken's House and Stellar Motel Stellar. Take it away.
When you're going out, you live in your own scene. When you need to shout, you dance in your own dream. When the night is long, when the night is long, when you're in your song, the moon's in the blue trees, the sea of light. Let's pretend that the world's free. When the night is long, 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 when the night is long.
We've actually got a video of Mike Doty and me jamming on our banjos right here in the studio. You can find it at our website, thetakeaway.org, where there are also pictures of Kristen Meinzer doing some bungee jumping and driving an 18-wheeler on I-35 in Minnesota.
I'm just hanging out with Simon Pegg and all the other stars. That's all I'm doing.
All at our website. Thanks so much for listening. Kristen, thanks so much for being with us for this hour.
Thanks so much, John. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. I'm John Hockenberry, and you have a Merry Christmas. This is The Takeaway.
Your wires in the mainframe. When the night is long, 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 when the night is long.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.